This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 76. Brought to you in association with Archover, Smart Pension, and Synchron. I'm delighted to be joined today by Charlie Blackburn, CTO of InsurTech Azure, who are part owned by global giant AIG. Now, before all of you who don't know what MGAs are fall asleep, and all of you who do switch off, bear with me for one paragraph, assuming, of course, one can speak in paragraphs. A quick recap of the story so far. The strategic overview of InsurTech, as per Jonathan Howe's excellent 30,000 feet guide in LFP 061, is of enhancement, not disruption. As that was based on a survey of 1,300 InsurTech startups, we can take that not just as an opinion, but as a solidly based proposition. However, a couple of episodes ago, in LFP 074, Andy Rea of the reinsurer Munich Re discussed with us their concept of reinsurance as a service. Put simply and metaphorically, the ability to, as it were, just plug into the wall for your electricity slash reinsurance, which then leaves insurtechs free to do everything they might want to do, whilst avoiding falling into a regulatory net and needing a gazillion dollars of capital to be an actual insurance company. Andy, and I think I broke my idea of one paragraph here, but never mind, said that the key to the future were MGAs, managing general agents, but we barely skimmed the surface on them, and I'm indebted to the sharp-eared, if that doesn't sound too Vulcan, Mark Holding for spotting this gap and introducing me to Azure, who absolutely inhabit it. So, long story short, seems to me that the largest disruptive potential, in the opinion of deep insurance insiders, goes straight down MGA Strasse. Anyway, before we leap to conclusions, let's understand more about MGAs in the first place. Where have they historically fitted into the three-tier structure of the insurance market? Brokers, insurers, reinsurers. What's changed? Where's it all going? Why are we here? Plenty to talk about. So let's get on with the show. Hi, Charlie. Thanks for joining me today.
Mike, lovely to be here.
And as always, I try and find that people are human beings. And you said you snowboarded, and being slightly over 30, like me, you thought that sort of snowboarding was quite cool. But as I hang out with all these fintechs, you see, I know that sort of snowboarding is a very old hat and you need to at least be kite surfing now. So.
Well, I think as far as I can tell with my children, I'm single-handedly putting off the next generation of snowboarding because they don't seem very interested to participate.
Oh, good. So it's about time I went skiing again because presumably skiing's back in fashion, actually. How old are your kids?
My kids are sort of doing GCSEs that age, so 14, 15.
My younger is just doing A-levels at the moment. And you've got boys or girls?
I have a girl. No, actually, I got that wrong already. She's 16, not 15, so she won't be listening to this. And a 14-year-old boy.
Oh, I see. Well, I've got two girls, so I've got almost a statistical sample, and I was told when I was very young that the thing to do at the age of 10, below 10 you want girls, because they think that daddy is wonderful and can do everything. And then at the age of 10 you then want to switch them for boys, you see, because then the girls rapidly realise that daddy doesn't know anything at all, and the things that he knows are utterly irrelevant, and there's plenty of sort of eye-rolling and all that kind of stuff. So I don't know whether your 16-year-old has turned into somebody who, from the age of 6, she thought you were wonderful, but now she knows that you know nothing important about anything. Fashion, boys.
I think we have all the fun dad-girl days ahead of us, so I'm ready for that, I think.
Excellent. I don't think anybody's ready for that. Glossing over. Anyway, rather than talking about sort of the slightly unhip snowboarding, you were going to tell me about business development and your great experience of business development with some of the sort of the biggest people in the world.
Yeah, well, you asked me to come up with something relevant and interesting in fintech.
Not in fintech. The rest of the world is not fintech.
I know. Well, it was sort of late 90s, and I was in California, and the company I was working for had been bought by Mike Milken, the junk bond king, and we were trying to sell the company and the product, and he asked me to call Mike Bloomberg, who was a mate of his. You know, they're all mates, all these billionaires.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Mike Bloomberg goes, oh yeah, Milken, I kind of know him. I think I know him. Anyway, I thought everyone knew Mike Milken, and I was wrong. And anyway, I used the line that Mike Milken had given me to pitch Mike Bloomberg, who immediately says, that is the worst sales pitch I've ever heard, and pretty much hung up, and we didn't sell anything. And so my career with billionaire sales processes seems a little short-lived, but that was about as good as I could do for you.
Oh, fantastic. Well, no, that's quite a good story, actually. And You haven't got no hair. You're going in that direction.
Heading there first.
Heading, no pun intended, but quite a long way behind me. It's quite interesting, actually, because I've been focusing recently on sort of how it's actually quite hard being English these days and how it doesn't really exist. Mind you, if Scotland go and then Wales go and then Europe goes one way or another, we'll actually have to rediscover what being English is.
Yes, apparently that's the trendy thing. I thought being mid-Atlantic was frightfully useful.
But well, everything is mid-Atlantic.
Apparently not. No, I need to be English.
Oh, I see. Oh, OK. Well, you and I might actually come back into fashion after all, however unlikely that is, because certainly sort of amongst younger folks, it's a very Americanized paradigm. So before that sounds terribly racist, I'll take a step back and that one of the people I listen to most and who's actually met a handful of times and has given me some excellent advice. There's a chap called Luangpo Somedo, who is a Buddhist monk who's been a monk for over 50 years and is the longest serving one in America. Very interesting guy. He started in the Peace Corps. He was teaching English in Borneo back in the 60s or 70s and was married and divorced and has still done 50 years as a monk. And he was originally American, but he spent a lot of time in Thailand and then a lot of time in England, and now he's retired into Thailand. And he said that if you ask an American to tell you about themselves, they'll tell you how wonderful they are, you know, how they're sort of friends of the president and, you know, yada, yada, yada. And he said, if you ask a sort of a British person or an English person to tell you about themselves, they'll start going about all their faults, everything they've ever got wrong. So you're definitely sort of English on that basis. But I've noticed that in terms of the younger generation being mid-Atlantic or Americanized, you know, it's all this sort of LinkedIn stuff. I mean, everybody's bloody wonderful. Everyone's Facebook. They're a hero on their own Facebook page and all this kind of shit.
And it's a very popular topic of conversation at the moment, this sort of, do you live the dream, pretend to be a part of it, or are you somehow yourself? And it's quite hard, I think, for people.
Yes, and I saw some survey actually talking of girls about 20 to 24-year-old women in the UK. And last year, I think 21% had reported mental health issues. And again, it's been proven many times that one of the ways to be less depressed is actually to get off Facebook and all that kind of stuff, because there's all this kind of, it's kind of an identity politics in a way, which is you've got to look glamorous and, you know, everything's got to be cool and you never cock anything up and you're all wonderful and, you know, you're going to parties all the time and you're having great sex all the time and all this kind of stuff, which sort of happens for next to nobody. So, I think that's all very depressing, actually. We used to talk about InsurTech. That's going to be much more interesting than the woes of the youngsters. Although, actually, my youngsters and Bridget, my partner's youngsters, they do say that whilst all this is true, there are equally a whole bunch of positives on the other side.
No, I think these friendships, you know, online friendships are just as real as real friendships. And you've got lots of friends. That's good in general, wherever they are.
And the possibilities are so much greater now than it was when we were young. So it's a very long story short. But actually, my current partner, we had a trans separation for 35 years. But when I was 18, she baked me a birthday cake and I smuggled her in from the girls' school. Actually, I had an office at the school. It's going to be a long story short. And I had a cake and that was that. Now, my younger daughter, who's just been 18, she went with her boyfriend to Rome. Yeah. I mean, back in that day, I couldn't conceive of going from Birmingham to London for a day out together. We wouldn't have been let to do that.
But it also feels quite nice and old-fashioned, right? Wasn't that what they did 150 years ago, go off to Rome and the grand European tour or whatever?
Yes, 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 it's just so. So moving swiftly on to the career journey, one of your many claims to fame, which you're glossing over, is something called Bright Talk, which I must confess to knowing the name, and that I've heard it around a bit, but like many of the things, most of the world is on the periphery of my vision. I've never quite sure what Bright Talk was, but you were just telling me what a huge enterprise it is.
It is, yes. I started it with a colleague, Paul Heald, in 2002, and it started out as a technology play, sort of content marketing tool. This is about 4 years before YouTube started, so we were definitely in early. And over time, has become a very successful company. It's about 150 people. It has an audience of about 5 million business professionals.
Slightly more than this podcast, only slightly.
But it covers more topics. If you roll up all the niches, you get to a large number. Anyway, Paul's now running that. I left that 3 years ago, and he's doing a cracking job. And Bright Talk goes from strength to strength.
And so what does it do today? I mean, what should the listeners, why should they check Bright Talk out?
It's basically a marketplace for people selling primarily technology products to reach an audience. So using content marketing, the favoured tool there are webinars, so live events, are very much the dynamics of the B2B media industry, you know, on a digital platform. And they've been working at that long enough to be pretty good at it.
Oh, I see. Yes, I did some webinar for a client last year and that. I was just coming sort of to chit-chat to be the person putting into context and that kind of thing. And going back to podcasts, I'm often asked for recommendations of podcasts. And one of the ones I listen to longest is something called The Marketing Companion with Mark Schaefer and Tom Webster. And they've been banging on about content marketing for a long, long, long time. So how did you end up going from BrightTALK to InsurTech? MGAs.
In the way of the world, one of the non-execs at BrightTALK, who's actually now the chairman of BrightTALK, is Graham Elliott, and Graham Elliott is the Azure CEO. So by route of digital marketing, Graham has been in the insurance industry for 5 years or so, most recently running Aqua, part of RK Harrison, and he wanted to set up a new company, and he deliberately wanted to get someone in who wasn't from the insurance industry from a technology point of view. So I've been sort of learning my way around insurance and trying to bring in techniques that are very prevalent outside of insurance into insurance.
Yes, and I mean, Andy mentioned MGA as a phrase in the context of Lloyd's, and certainly Lloyd's, a bit like the civil service, has been one of these things where there have been sort of whole generations of CTOs who have come and gone. I've tried to sort of assault the citadel and never actually quite got through the front door.
Well, and it is interesting because in many ways they were obviously the original sort of big data people, you know.
Absolutely,
sat there,
yes.
You know, recording which of the ships foundered on the rocks as they left Athens or whatever, and knowing which captains. And so if you then say what you've got in insurance is some people who are really good at data, historically been excellent at data, they seem to struggle a bit, I think, with the logic, the algorithms and the coding bit. And, you know, I wasn't there, so I don't quite know why that happened. But you say, this is a data-intensive business. If you get really good technology platforms, you can really grow a good business.
So we're stuck with this MGA phrase. You know, you're stuck with the MGA phrase because you are an MGA, and it will mean a hell of a lot to people who are in insurance. But to people outside insurance, can we just start with what were MGAs? I mean, I looked it up on the train in my usual in-depth research. I looked at Wikipedia, which just sort of banged on about East Coast America and, you know, opening businesses in Wisconsin and some sort of complicated thing about Canada proving their insurer to America and vice versa. So that's one perspective. Andy mentioned, say, Lloyd's insurance market, which is a very specific, although very successful insurance market in the UK. But if it's possible to put it simply and clearly, he says, giving you a hospital pass, what is an MGA, simply and clearly? Or neither of those, if you like.
I guess they're kind of a type of organisation, but quite specific type of organisation. They have underwriting authority, you know, given to them by a carrier, in our case, AIG, and they generally focus on niches. So they're a specialist, whereas obviously the big elephants, we all know, cover all the major markets. MGAs generally have a very specific competence. It means we have underwriters, we have a claims team, they're all outside. So we are very much a traditional insurance company, but very much as a smaller niche part of the industry.
And so how do you interface, if you interface at all, between brokers who historically were the way in which people accessed capacity, whether they were individuals or corporates, and insurance companies and reinsurance, and just going back to this simple stack model?
Yes, we sell through an intermediated channel, so we work with all the big brokers. Our initial book is the book we got from AIG, which is the high net worth book. And so we'll work with, and our customers, all the big brokers you know well.
How big is that book?
That book is about 25 million in premium. So what we wanted, rather than trying to build something from scratch as an MGA, we wanted to start with a market and then build from there.
Okay, well, that seems simple and clear.
I'll have another go as we go along, so we can get some clarity.
Maybe we just pull stumps now and go, that was it. Thank
you
very much.
The way I think about them, they're a bit like hedge funds if you go into the asset management world. So they can do slightly different things than a long-only fund, but at the end of the day, they're still buying shares, investing in shares, putting investment money into different forms of equity.
Right. And so in terms of what MGAs were, they're kind of in these specialist niche markets that you're talking about, they're another layer between the brokers and the insurance companies. So how do they manage to squeeze themselves in at the sort of the lunch table and stick their elbows out and share some of the meal?
Like all these things, if you have a company of a certain size or over a certain size, it does become quite hard. And if you've got, we're sort of 50 people, we're very focused on what we're doing. We can also offer the carriers variable costs because, you know, we're paid, you know, by the policy.
When you say carriers, that's obviously a technical word.
Sorry, insurance companies.
Right.
So the big traditional AIGs and all those kind of companies, we offer the ability to work on a variable basis. So that's quite attractive to them.
And a variable basis meaning?
Meaning that as we sell more policies, a share of each policy, they pay us a fee for each share of the policy. So rather than them saying, oh, let's get into this niche market, we need to hire all these underwriters, we need to hire this team,
we've got
this product. You know, that is hard for big companies to do in niche areas.
Oh, that's interesting. So rather than seeing an MGA just as another sort of slice on a layer cake or some middleware interfacing between two things, one can see it, as you say, as a customer acquisition vehicle in particular areas. And going back to sort of big companies and thinking of pharma for quite a long time has got too big to be able to do much innovation. So it tends to sort of, you know, hoover up a few biotech firms and get the ideas and, in a sense, has outsourced a lot of the innovation. And one of the arguments for high drug prices is that the drug companies are innovating, but actually they're not really very innovating at all in that particular regard. So then the question arises, as you say, that sort of once MGAs get sort of too big for their boots, too successful, presumably they do start sort of encroaching on people's territory, so they get sort of bought or assimilated by the Borg or something like that, and you just become another division. Because, I didn't know, when I was talking to Andy, I was giving the example of racing Aston Martins around a track. Presumably if that market gets infinite, then all the big insurance companies can actually set up a division to do.
Yeah, I think we see there's a really good opportunity for an independent company. So we have minority shareholders. So we are not beholden either to a broker or to an insurer. And I think that independence is quite important. And one of the things that Andy said, he saw the MGA traditionally being owned by the brokers. And we think that will limit your amount of freedom. We want the ability to serve a marketplace and offer any capital that we want, and we don't really want to be tied to the relationships that the brokers may have.
Right. And what's the kind of regulatory status of an MGA?
So an MGA is regulated.
Is it regulated as an MGA? Is there a whole chapter in the insurance regulation manual saying this is an MGA, blah, blah, blah?
As far as you're concerned, you know, we're regulated. We don't have our own capital, so the regulation is slightly differently. But no, we're umbrellaed at the moment, but we've put our Part 4 submission in and we'll be regulated as any other part of the insurance industry.
What are the insurance regulators called? I mean, it's not the Bank of England.
No, it's the FCA. So we're regulated by the FCA. So we fall under their ambit.
Ah, interesting. Yeah, I mean, the reason being interesting, of course, is when it was the FSA, then I can understand that the FSA regulated everything. But of course, as you know, in some ways, the banking and insurance are sort of mirror images of each other, and that one tends to concentrate on liabilities and the other tends to concentrate on an asset. So in a sense, they're symmetrical, but then they can end up being treated differently. So when the FSA split in the UK, it became the FCA, which on the banking side and all that kind of fintechy side, tended to worry about sort of consumers being misled and all that kind of stuff. And then the PRA, which went back to the Bank of England, which is where it came in the first place, which quotes all the sort of, you know, the quotes clever, unquotes, folks looking at, you know, all the risk models and all that kind of stuff within banks and going, oh, I don't think that's sort of phi over theta, it's four times alpha over kappa or something like that. So the kind of clever, gloggy people who understood all the minutiae went to the Bank of England. But actually, what you're saying is that in the FCA, the people who sat there and says, oh, I don't know, Aviva hasn't got enough capital, are still at the FCA.
Yes, and it is quite interesting, sort of having come from the non-regulated part of the world. We're trying to be agile, we're also regulated. And now you can either say, golly, you know, isn't that a bit schizophrenic? But if we can get good at it, we'd say that's quite a good opportunity. And part of what Andy was saying last week about, you know, reinsurance as a service is they want to provide the regulation to the insurtechs, who are these super whip smart digital natives who've come from, you know, other industries and are seeing the consumer as a great opportunity. And we actually think you've got to put those two together.
Yes, absolutely. And it is one of the secrets, of course, of fintech, because it's a heavily regulated industry. Why people ever volunteer to come into a heavily regulated industry, I don't know. I mean, I started in the city and it was barely regulated at all. And actually that had succeeded as a business model pretty much for 200 years.
But it's not Warren Buffett's favourite industry for no reason. You know, there's a lot of great opportunities for companies like ours in such a big industry. You know, if you sort of want to set up a new e-shopping service or something, you'll find it's fairly competitive and quite hard. But actually, insurance feels more doable if you're a startup.
Yes, and I think there are important distinctions. I mean, in the first case, any regulation, whether it's of energy or aviation or of banking, protects the incumbents, net-net, and the incumbents have had a lot of say over the definition of it. So it's a barrier to entry. I think one of the differences is that insurance, even if parts of it do upset their consumers more than they could do with doing, actually does provide a service and does add value to people's lives, unlike, shall we say, the whole of fund management, which actually is proven over decades, having been a fund manager myself, to subtract value for the clients, or mergers and acquisitions in corporate finance, which again, the average one goes badly wrong. And then, of course, on the banking side, the burden of regulation, 4,500 compliance officers in HSBC London alone, reduces the profitability of banks in a world in banking where, unlike steel companies or shipping companies, banks aren't really let to go bust. So there's overcapacity. So surprise, surprise, you know, come a decade later, banks have had to find some way of pushing the envelope somewhere to make money to cover all these bloody costs. And it gets worse and worse. And, you know, it's not just my hypothesis. Lord Turner was on the show last year talking about a lot of these things around how do you correctly regulate banking. So I agree that there are advantages, but this may be me seeing it from my side of the fence. The insurance market, which didn't have a 2008, although Lloyd's had its whatever it was, 1998 or whenever it was, I've lost track of time now, is a little bit more stable, and the likes of me do need insurance for my car and my house. And moving on, so you are regulated by the FCA, which still does the insurance regulation. I mean, Lloyd's itself is still kind of self-regulated, isn't it? So I don't really like this whole philosophy thing of discussing really what words mean. But, you know, in what sense are you kind of an insurance company or an MGA? In what sense are you an insurtech? And does it actually matter? Because all we're talking about here is how the world of digital is just changing financial services in general. So it doesn't really matter which box you put yourself in. But do you see boxes? Do you think they've got any meaning? Do you think insurtech has got meaning?
You do, in the sense that, you know, both from a regulation point of view, and I sit next to the claims team, and you've got people who've usually had something bad happen to them, and you've got to know what you're doing and how to help solve that problem. So, you know, there's a real existing business that is very good at those kinds of things. At the same time, a lot of insurance technology has been sort of back office. So we are working pretty hard at the customer experience bit. So we've hired UX people. You know, we've got our own in-house tech team here. We've gone out to other industries to pull in, you know, very, very good developers. We run a culture that you would find in any industry startup, you know, any of the great businesses that are coming, because that's how people want to be treated. You know, that's how you get the best people. That's how you keep the best people. So we do have to be both. We have to be great at claims, and we also have to be this innovation company. And we see, you know, you have covered it a lot in some of the content you've done. There is, you know, all this machine learning, there's telematics, you know, there's data, hose pipes of data coming through. A lot of that data really is good behavioral and risk data that is much more useful for underwriting, and I'm not talking about social media or some of the other slight peripheries, than what's probably being used at the moment. Some of the rating methods probably need an upgrade, shall we say. And so that is the opportunity, is to get good at the technology as well as being a really good insurance company.
Interesting. I mean, it's quite a good answer from my perspective, because when I started the show 3 years ago, in terms of the logo for the London FinTech podcast, I chose the picture of Tower Bridge, because I saw sort of, you know, as it were, on one side of the river, the incumbents, on the other side of the river, the startups, and that the future would be these two coming together.
Yeah.
Because, as you say, in FS as a whole, you need some strong ability and deep roots in terms of doing processes well that have gone around for centuries, whether it's lending and borrowing or whether it's claims processing. People have recognised that 100 years ago, 200 years ago, as far back as Swiss cows, according to John Kay when he was on the show. But equally, I mean, it's interesting, you know, you're wearing the CTO hat, maybe we'll talk about that a little bit, which is that, I mean, when I was in the IT industry, as it was called IT then, it wasn't called tech.
I'm sure it wasn't DP when you were doing it.
No. I was operating systems and compilers and Unix and C link editors and assemblers. This was 83, 84, when Unix was very unpopular, when programming languages were still very popular. But a lot has changed from those days about how you can do stuff. I mean, computers talk to each other and people talk to each other over computers, and we're inundated by digital and all this kind of stuff. And it must be an interesting challenge, in a sense, with a circle on one side and a square on the other, connecting these centuries-old processes and a bit more sort of digital sexy stuff.
Yeah, although in some ways the processes aren't quite as complicated as you might think. You know, policies have a set of questions and some relatively simple maths. And, you know, then we need to put the words on the paper and make sure we know exactly what we've done, and we can go back at any point and evidence some of the things we've done. So it's not necessarily rocket science.
It isn't. However, in traditional industries, whether it's sort of banking and Citigroup, or for the sake of argument, Aviva, large existing incumbents that have been around for a long time have got so many layers of architectures and computer programs here and systems there and Murexes and yard, and all the equivalent, that actually changing that can be a hell of a task.
Which is where the MGA comes in. You know, so we get to start with a blank sheet of paper, that mythical state, which is terrific because you get to jump on the smartphone as your start point. You've got cloud computing on the back end, you've got smartphones on the front end, you've got these great modular components that have been used in other systems that already talk to each other. So when you start, you're starting that much further up. You know, all your databases are encrypted, you know, systems are configurable, and that's just so much of a luxury to start from that point. And the other thing is, if you've only start with one book or one product, so we only care about, at the moment, homeowner, collection, and motor, quite a specific set of products, the technology's only got to work for those, but it needs to be done in a way that as we add other products, we can add them easily and quickly.
Yes, last episode with Nick Storonsky from Revolut, who have hit the ball out of the park in terms of customer acquisition, having gained 500,000 customers in 18 months.
I'm one of them, it's fantastic.
Are you? Oh, right, okay, interesting.
It's very impressive.
Oh, I was hoping you would say it's a complete rubbish, actually, because I'm an investor in Monzo, so...
Yes, and you can see, you know, where... And then the other one is Moneycorn. You can see they slightly always default to where they started from. So, you know, some of them will make more money on the exchange side of things. Others will say, look, we're a customer acquisition vehicle, therefore we're really going to be cost efficient and provide great value to the customer because we just want lots of customers.
Yes, I'm joking, actually, because I noticed that Revolut are doing a sort of crowdfunding at the moment, and I thought, well, maybe I should have some money in them. But I mean, just talking to Nick about the sort of the software development and all that kind of stuff, he, of course, was emphasising the modular stuff, which is what you absolutely need if they're doing what they're doing, which is you start off by offering tremendous value on interbank FX rates and transfers, but then you start adding this, that, and the other all around it.
And therefore, you do need good architects, and you've got a pretty good idea where you're going. And someone said something quite good to, I think it was to Graham, one of the things that made him successful, as soon as you see legacy, you get rid of it immediately. The way to keep these businesses moving fast, and in code terms, that's refactoring. You know, it's technical debt. So you've done something and it was done quickly and sort of for expedient purposes. You really want to get rid of that, because if you don't, when you want to do what you're talking about with Revolut and add new things, you'll find you can't add any new stuff because you're spending so much time looking after the old stuff.
Absolutely. And one of my joint fintechs of the year award last year was to Blue Motor Finance, and Bob Jones, who set that up, certainly won the award for being the eldest CEO on the London Fintech podcast in 75. And I was mentioning before, in terms of stories, he was telling the story about being at the first concert that Ringo did with the Beatles way back in the day, actually, as well as what the Cavern Club was really like, which I just can't forget now, even if I want to, which is that it stank of piss, actually, which they never actually mention on the BBC when they're doing retrospectives of the Beatles.
I thought everything was perfect back in those days.
Absolutely. And sanitised, no pun intended, or unsanitised, actually, pun intended. Anyway, he's run a whole bunch of very big firms, as well as sort of more startups and buy-ins and all that kind of stuff. And one of his principles that stuck in my mind was basically to sort of, I'm using a metaphor here or a caricature, but basically sort of to burn the place to the ground every 3 years.
Yeah, and that is hard, and that does take investment. So, you know, we're well funded. We do want to build this for the future. Hopefully we haven't built too much that we need to trash, because we've really only been, you know, hard at it for 7 months or so. But I think that's the reality. New things come along. We've invested in a machine learning platform. We think it's going to do great things for us. Now, in 2 years' time, is there a more bespoke insurance machine learning platform that's better? Who knows? But the idea, we would always look to upgrade either with third-party technology or what we're building ourselves with what we need.
Absolutely. And I think the principle is to disrupt oneself, is to always look in the mirror every now and then and go, we must be doing something wrong. What is it? Or we could be doing something better.
Yeah.
And if you're doing that, then you avoid the trap of being some vast incumbent like Three, my mobile phone provider, which is driving me around the bend at the moment. Okay, so if you're very successful as an MGA, from what you were saying before, actually you'll become significant and presumably someone who want to buy you.
We haven't really set up the company with that in mind. Graham is very clear. He's, you know, out to build a great company that sustains, you know, and if you're profitable and if you can look after your people and you recognise that, you know, people will come and go on to different stages of their career, there is no need necessarily to sell out. So if you've got a, I think that's the design point, is we want to be here for the long term, we want to do it right, and we want to give people that opportunity to stay and the company to be around for a long time.
Well, I think you mentioned Revolut. I think I recall that they've had an offer already, and Monzo have had an offer already. So, of course, the situation arises that if you do everything you say, then you become sort of attractive and sexy, and people want to come along and sort of hold your hand and that kind of stuff, and then you deal with that as it happens.
It is, and, you know, as everyone knows, acquisitions are seem to be like advertising, you know, 50% are brilliant and 50% less so. It is very hard, especially a sort of startup culture where the team really own it, to go too early in terms of acquisition and then preserve that company as a big, important company in the future.
Yes, I don't know the maths either for Revolut or Monzo, but I thought strategically it was absolutely the right thing for them to do to turn down the offer, unless it was a completely crazy offer. And this was their logic, I understand, both of them, and there's not much overlap in a sense from the founders, that they've got different sort of cultures, precisely because they set out to do something and they feel they haven't done it yet.
Yeah, and you've got to have the right capital. So whoever's backing them has got to be on the journey with them. And you do have to line these things up. The more strategic you can be, the better chance you have of succeeding, even though some of us sort of fall into entrepreneurialism and opportunities. Increasingly, you need to be converged as best you can.
Right. Well, that's very helpful and very clear on the MGAs. And I'm glad we've touched on the tech debt. We don't often get too much on the sort of the tech side of it. There aren't as many CTOs as you, Charlie, who actually get let out of the office now and then.
Yes, I don't really see myself as a traditional CTO. And as everyone who knows me, who is listening to this, they're probably having a little smile that I call myself a CTO, but whatever. That, it is what it is.
Yes, exactly. Keep faking it until you make it. You certainly don't have the sort of the breast pocket full of pencils or whatever you're supposed to have for that kind of thing. So before we move on to Azure, and I think my first question is, why isn't there an E at the end? Because I think Azure is spelled Azure, but I mean it's Azure. Anyway, you can tell me about the pronunciation and where the E went. I'd like to thank the listeners to the show. If you all weren't there, there wouldn't be much point doing this, and it's good to hear from so many of you and find out that plenty of you have learned some stuff. I certainly have myself. I'd also like to thank my brand partners for the podcast who make all this possible. Archover, smart, simple and transparent P2P business lending. Loans to £3 million for SMEs to living up to 7% secured, insured returns to lenders. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrollment.co.uk. Synchron, digital business consulting and technology services for top-tier FS, from startup to 7,000 people, 18 countries, and $400 million of revenue. So, as I say, rudely segued, so how come Azure is spelled Azure as in A-Z-U-R, and not Azure as in sort of the thing you might have on a ring?
Well, I think when you get into four-letter names, you'll find a lot of them have been taken, and obviously there's a well-known technology platform called Azure from a big Seattle-based company. Originally, we wanted to be Truffle.
I've had Trussle on the podcast.
We wanted to be Truffle, but we were told that if you want to be any kind of well-regarded company in insurance, you had to start with an A.
Ah.
So we got to Azure, and so everything's blue around here.
Well, I think certainly it was always the case back in the day that the studies that I'd seen was that if you got a name early in the alphabet, you tended to do better at school. And as you're a B and I'm a B, I think we can probably sort of both agree, actually.
I knew it was something random like that.
Yes. Well, fortunately, when I was at school, you got called by your surname, because otherwise M for Mike would have put me in the middle of the pack. So moving on from naming companies, and certainly I had my own shock in 1998 when I had to sort of set up my own company, having gone independent and still being independent, in that I had lots of good ideas for company names, and I typed them into the company's house and said to base, oh, can't have that one, oh, can't have that one. So about three quarters of a day later, you're really straining your brain. You've used at least half the words you know in English, and they've all been taken. So what are Azure selling to who at the moment? What do you want more of? And for the not quite 5 million listeners out there, but almost 5 million listeners, which of them should be coming and knocking your door down because you're just the sort of ticket for them at the moment?
Well, we're a B2B company, so we sell through brokers. We are always looking to put new products out in the marketplace. So both on the capital side, so reinsurers and people with capital, and on the broker side, people who think that there must be a better product to put together. We think we've got a great technology platform and a great team to put new products together. So those are the people we're interested in talking to.
Excellent. And in terms of the future, where do you see yourselves going over the next 1, 2, 3 years?
We'll add new products. So as I said, we're currently in the high net worth space, but there's a lot going on in markets like cyber. There's different niches within some of the motor industry. So you'll see us popping up around niches. We like anything that allows us to add a better customer experience and new ways of helping the customer get their insurance.
And just briefly, how does geography work these days, or how will it work post-Brexit? We don't probably know, but one of the things I saw in terms of saber-rattling from Europe or sort of bitterness in the divorce was something saying that, oh, we're going to make sure that no fintechs can expand into Europe once those bastards leave and da-da-da-da-da. I mean, a lot of fintechs, I mean, it's almost all fintechs that I've met in the UK are actually just UK-focused at this stage. Very, very few are sort of talking about taking on the world, talking about the opposite mentality of Americans.
It's a good question. We're a little schizophrenic and lots of opportunities seem to pop up. Because on the one hand, we're building a platform that we think is usable elsewhere. So you could kind of lift and shift the platform bit of what we do, the tech bit, into the US. We're working on, you know, global cloud platform. We are very focused on the UK, but capital providers want us to take the platform into different geographies in Europe. And similarly, you know, some of our big partners have very big global footprints. So we'll see where the opportunities take us.
Yes, and we're talking about regulation. I mean, the more rules and the more laws one has around anything, the more complicated it gets to do stuff. But from the Holy Roman Empire and before and going forwards, there will always be a way to do something. You know, if there is a firm, as far as I'm concerned, in the UK, and it's really good at doing what it's doing, and as you say, sort of, you know, lift and shift, I quite like the phrase, then there'll be some way to make it happen in Bulgaria in 10 years' time, if that turns out to be where the opportunity is.
There's probably some truth in the fact that, you know, the UK is doing pretty well on conduct and compliance and regulation, and probably there's some stuff that other jurisdictions would like to take what we've done. So I do think we're becoming pretty good at some of these capabilities.
Yes, there's a lot of leadership. I mean, I personally think that, and Peter Renton's my source for this, the chap from Lend Academy, who organises Lend at the biggest P2P conferences in the world, he's immensely impressed by what's going on in China, not just in size, which is humongous, but actually just in terms of technology and, you know, what's happening. And Nick from Revolut last week was talking about WeChat or whatever. So actually there's a lot of leadership from out there, you know, which I don't know very much of. If we exclude China and Asia, then actually, notwithstanding whether we will always be European, whether we're in the EU or EEA or whatever, in or out, or how it's all changing, I think there still does remain, going back to the Beatles, there still does remain quite a bit of sort of intellectual leadership from the UK. So opportunities will continue to abound. And I thank you very much for that, Charlie. It's been very clear, very interesting. It's nice to meet somebody who, as it were, is straddling areas of incumbency and areas of tech. We're finally getting this convergence that I've been waiting to see for several years. And I wish you every success in the future.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory / non-exec, or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, but with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so grey, with the pain of the everyday. the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight.